Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to the Badass Women's Hour podcast. Three women, one podcast, and a whole load of badass. This week, we meet comedian Juliet Burton, who talks to us about mental health. We also meet Eunice Olamide, supermodel and fashion designer, who explains just why the fashion industry isn't how you think it is. And we, of course, announce our Badass of the Week.
Underwear, armpit hair, many imitators, but no one compares.
Badass Women's Hour XL with Harriet Minter, Natalie Campbell and Emma Sexton on Talk Radio.
One, two, three, four!
So they say that laughter is the best medicine and it can help everyone else. I also think that kindness is a pretty good cure too. And we are lucky enough to have in the studio with us now Juliet Burton, who's on her new tour, which is all about how we should be more kind to each other. Juliet, welcome.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. Oh. You guys are so inspiring. I'm very happy to be here.
Thank you. What a lovely thing to start us off with. Thanks so much. So I'm going to talk to you about the tour and about kindness, but first of all, I want to talk to you about how you got into comedy. Tell us that story.
Sure. Right. Well, I first used to be a radio broadcast journalist.
Our future is in front of our eyes.
I used to be a journalist because I didn't get any A levels because I fell out of education, which I'm sure we'll get onto later. But I ended up being a journalist because turned out you didn't need to have any A levels for that. I also did love it, but I didn't quite fit in. Ended up doing voiceover work, and then voiceover work led to acting, and then acting led to me realising that if I wanted any good parts as a woman, I needed to write my own stuff. And if I was going to write my own stuff, I found myself laughing a lot and wanting to make other people laugh. And I very quickly found out that if I made people laugh, I could talk about maybe darker subjects and darker experiences that I've been through. And if I made people laugh, they might listen for a little bit longer. So then I ended up working in comedy, and it's been many, many years. But this is my first proper national tour, which I'm really excited about. So sold out the last 4 years in a row in Edinburgh, every single show, which is amazing, and bigger and bigger venues, which is lovely. It's coming to London.
So I loved what you said there about feeling like you didn't fit in, because that seems to be a bit of a theme for comedians generally. They see the world differently, and actually it's only when they have a platform to be able to make the world laugh at it that their view is heard, as opposed to everyone being a bit like,
Well, comedy's meant to tread like the fringes of society, like between what's acceptable to say and what's not acceptable to say. And it's all about trying to find a new twist on an old idea. So building up tension and then twisting it around within the story, the setup, punchline, gag. And I love comedy because it's a tension relief, and I'm a great source of tension to my family and most of my friends and myself. So being able to relieve that tension with laughter is a really powerful thing. And I think that being able to say things that are unacceptable to some people, or perhaps the subject matter is difficult to handle without a lightness of touch. For me, comedy is definitely the light in the darkness, and my mind can take me to some really dark places, and my life has taken me to some quite dark places. And I think being able to seek out the light is almost like a survival technique, really. And I think that's true for a lot of not only comedians but just all of us. Being able to have a laugh and find the light, especially in the sort of times that we're living in right now.
Absolutely.
Emma. Sorry, what are the topics that you touch on in terms of your show? You're saying that you talk about some darker topics and you try and bring some humour in the hope that you can talk about those topics a bit longer. What are the sort of topics that you inspire your show?
So the first time that I started doing comedy, I didn't talk about this stuff, but in the last few years, more and more I've spoken about my mental health conditions. And that's something that's still... It isn't the only topic I talk about within the shows. And this particular show also covers kindness, which again, I'm sure we're going to get onto. But with my mental health, it's always going to sort of colour my view on the world. So I was sectioned when I was 17, and I was spent my 18th birthday in hospital, sectioned under the Mental Health Act. I was in and out of hospital throughout my teenage years, and I spent most of my teenage years getting more and more diagnoses for different conditions. And looking back, I was probably undiagnosed in my childhood with like anxiety disorder and obsessive compulsive disorder and problems with food. And it was when I was 14, that was my first diagnosis, was of anorexia, and that's what led me to being sectioned. And when I was sectioned, I had hallucinations, so the stress of being sectioned, because when you're sectioned, I don't know if you know
this. For anyone who doesn't know.
Yes, so being sectioned under the Mental Health Act is like being detained. A psychosis is having audible and visual hallucinations, and I'm now an ambassador for Rethink Mental Illness, and one of their campaigns at the moment is calling for reform to the Mental Health Act. So when you get sectioned under the Mental Health Act, you don't have any rights. And they would like, with their campaign 35 days to 35 years, they'd like to reform because when you get sectioned, when I got sectioned, I didn't have any rights, and the stress of not being explained what was happening to me, that led to me having a quite avoidable psychosis, perhaps. So yeah, I've collected a lot of labels, got more labels than TK Maxx, and I like making people laugh about it, because I've found that actually it seems to matter to people. The people, when I first started doing comedy about my mental health, I was so scared, terrified of what people would think of me. I was raising money at the time for Mind, because the mental health charity Mind, because it was 10 years to the year that I got sectioned, and I thought I needed to tell the audiences why we'd chosen this charity. And coming out was so scary, and nowadays it's almost like it's a selling point that people want to come and laugh at me talking about my mental health experiences, because it gives them permission to laugh at themselves and their own experiences, and gives them permission to talk and be more open.
What's it like to repeatedly talk about stuff that was traumatic for you? So I am a huge fan of Hannah Gadsby and her special,
Nanette is amazing. Nanette,
special on Netflix, Nanette,
yeah,
in which she talks about her own kind of journey through life and a lot about her mental health and about her sexuality and about the incredible abuse that she suffered along the way. And you know, she said that psychiatrists see her as a test case because they don't know what it's going to be like to repeat those experiences every night live on stage. For you, what is that like?
Well, I'm not going to lie, there's different layers to it. So the first kind of time that I built a routine that was really solid around my mental health conditions, that routine is great, and the butt of the joke is always either the condition or the misconceptions people might have about mental illness. And then I started finding that there's still a lot of stigma. I'd come off stage and I'd repeatedly be asked the same questions again and again and again. So then the next batch of routines I put together was tackling that stigma that I encountered. And then there's the next layer of that people seem to assume that because I'm talking about it, it means I'm magically cured. And actually, I still live with my eating disorders and my anxiety disorder and my depression and my bipolar disorder. They're all still there in my head, and I'm still battling with them, as well as my inner critic and my self-doubt. And on top of that, you have reviewers who maybe sometimes are a little bit patronizing, or sometimes misunderstanding where you're going with it, or there's so many layers to uncover with it. So it's a constant source of absurdity, I think. Like, the very world that we're living in at the moment is far more insane than I ever think I was. So being able to speak from that fringes that we were speaking about earlier on, like being committed, detained, it kind of puts you in the box of outcast anyway. So comedy is a natural home because we're all of us trying to look from the outside in to the insanity of the world that we're living in. So I just maybe have more credentials than some others. It is interesting. And I also would say comedy is not therapy. And if you need therapy, go to therapy. Don't get up on stage and start talking into a microphone. Unless they're not laughing, in which case I will still call my comedy therapy. But I love doing it, and I still have a therapist. So I still processed the raw stuff that I still am feeling too raw with. That goes to therapy with me. And the stuff that once I've processed it and I've learnt to distance myself a little bit and I'm laughing at it, that's when it comes with me to comedy. But there is some dissonance. There's a very strange gap that I think you're touching on with people like Hannah Gadsby and now myself as well. I tend to put a lot of sparkles on stage and wear a hell of a lot of sequins. And when the going gets tough, the tough gets sparkly. And sometimes it's really lovely to be a bit more real. Sometimes the sparkles give you permission to be more real.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask, what were the questions that people would ask that showed that they're... that they were ultimately judging you, or they had their own barriers or you know, the discussion around stigma? What were the sorts of things that they'd ask you?
Well, I wouldn't want to put off anyone from coming to chat to me afterwards, because asking questions is the best thing. Mm. And not being afraid to ask questions. But having said that, the things that I still get frustrated by are things like, when did you get better? What was the one thing that caused it? Do you blame your parents for it? How can you be ill? You don't look ill. The classic and the very first time that I started building a routine was after a guy, usually a guy, said to me afterwards, mental illness isn't an illness, it's an attention-seeking ploy.
Wow.
Which I didn't really believe that people still felt that way. Like when I was in my teens and being diagnosed, I got that attitude of, oh, it's attention seeking, you're just doing it for attention. I got that quite a lot. But this was sort of 2015, 2014 that I had people saying that to me. I have that less now, but I still do get, oh, I don't understand why you've got a problem with your image. I mean, you're a very pretty girl, which is very lovely and sweet, and they think they're helping, but looks change and fade, and I am not my looks, and mental illness has nothing to do with our bodies. It's about how we exist within them and our relationship to the outside world, and it's nuanced, and it's not very soundbitey to say that, I guess. So,
but yeah. I was going to ask that question.
Keep asking questions.
Which was about the one thing. So you said that you were diagnosed with OCD.
That was one of my diagnoses.
One of them. And so the thing that automatically went off in my mind was, well, was that the first thing that was undiagnosed, and then that was then connected to food? Because I think I've got cousins who won't eat tomatoes or will only eat red things or only eat Weetabix or will only eat chips, and that progresses over time. So I was already trying to do that analysis in my own head. Mm. And I think it's natural to do that if you're curious.
We're going to think about it.
Sure. Let's think
about
it.
Take a little break while we think about it. We are going to be continuing to talk to Juliet Burton, comedian, about mental health and comedy and the link between them two here on Badass Women's Hour XL.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues. your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Badass Women's Hour XL on Talk Radio.
She'll get you talking.
Keep begging you for mercy. Why won't you release me? You got me begging you for mercy. Why won't you release me?
Welcome back to Badass Women's Hour XL with me, Harriet Minter, Natalie Campbell and Emma Sexton, a little bit Duffy. In the studio we have Juliet Burton, comedian, and just shedding a total light on mental health, I think, for all of us tonight. Before the break, we were asking about the links between OCD and eating disorders. Juliet, how did that work for you?
Right. So when I was a child, I first started exhibiting problems with food, but I think that was mainly linked to anxiety disorder that was undiagnosed. But this is all kind of looking back retrospectively, and it's very freeing now to be able to say to myself, it doesn't really matter why, what caused it, because I can delve into that for as much as I like. All that really matters is what I'm dealing with right now. I think that I like to think of my mental health conditions as a tree, because I've had multiple diagnoses, and I think of it as like there's a trunk of the tree, so maybe that's the anxiety disorder, and that then linked off, or my bipolar, to be sorry, more correct, that then split off into anxiety and depression, and as coping tools to cope with the anxiety, I developed obsessive compulsive disorder, other anxiety related conditions like body dysmorphic disorder, which is a problem with how I perceive my body at times of great stress and anxiety, and also a different like my anorexia, my bulimia, my compulsive overeating disorder. They are all linked to anxiety, problems with managing anxiety disorder. So I think they're all interlinked and interwoven, but they are not me, and I am more than they are. I am who I am because of and in spite of those conditions. And the great thing with mental illness is that it the great thing with being mentally ill is that I think it teaches you a lot. It teaches you empathy, it teaches you the power of kindness, it also teaches you a lot about what it means to be human and flawed and fallible and how resilient we are. Because actually, I think all of us really have, we all have mental health, we all have mental well-being. We either have good mental health or bad mental health on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned there the importance of kindness.
Yeah.
Your new show is all about kindness.
Yes.
Tell us why that is.
Right. Kindness is a very important thing to me. I think kindness can be life-saving. I know that small acts of kindness have meant that on certain days when I felt like I was drowning with my mental health conditions, I am not alone. There's actual faith in humanity out there still, even in this day and age. And if I focused on it, the more I gave, the more I received, the more I just picked up on it. It is everywhere. Last year I had a bit of a difficult year, and this year's not that much better, but I professionally it's going brilliantly. So I was struggling to cope, and I thought I needed to find new meaning in my life. So I tried to not only be kinder to other people, but also tried to be kind to myself, which my therapist kept telling me to do, and I really didn't know how to do it. So that is why I went off on this quest to do as many random acts of kindness as I possibly could to see whether it could change my world, the world, other people's world. I even know a guy that up in Edinburgh Fringe, when I flyered, whenever I flyer up there, you fly to sell your show, you chat to people. I like to really get to know one person at a time when I'm doing that and make them feel really valued, because they are. I feel alone most of the time. And this one guy that I met came to see my show the next day, came to see my show the following year. And then he said, because I have really loyal fans. He said the second time I met him, that the first day I flyered him, he'd been planning on committing suicide.
Oh, wow.
But the way that I chatted to him felt like the first act of kindness that anyone's shown him in a really long time. So he felt obligated to come see the show. That's how I get people like guilt-tripping him into it. And then he said he found the show so uplifting that he changed his mind, which is better than any five-star review or a comedy award, although I'm not going to turn down any five-star reviews or comedy awards. So kindness can save lives.
Mm. And how was the acts of kindness? Did you notice a difference in your mental health from focusing on these acts of kindness and giving more?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't say it definitely didn't cure the conditions, but it does give me, on a day-to-day basis, it helps me focus on something outside of myself, which helps me get away from the damaging thoughts that might spiral into my disorders and start helping my behaviour become damaging as well as my thoughts. So kindness, for me, doing acts of kindness is a way of getting strength. It's not weak to be empathetic or to show kindness. I believe it's a strong thing and a resilient thing to do kind things. And my audiences have taught me that, because in the show, I invite audiences to come up with suggestions of ways to be kind, and they write them on pieces of paper on the way into the show. And then they are then passing those on to my future audiences. So each audience member is daring a complete stranger at a future show to do a random act of kindness they've come up with. And I've been typing all these up as I go along and going on tour. And it's just so heartwarming. It really has just, when you're doubting, I meant to be writing this book at the moment about it, because looking through these suggestions, people are creative and kind and incredible.
What are your top three?
Top three. I would say laughing loudly at a comedy show is always a good one. I think another favourite one was putting together a care package for people who are currently without a home. So putting a care package together. And sending a goat to an African family, in a country that needs help. And so this person sent me a card from Oxfam saying, I did this and here's the card. And they've sent the goat to, not to your venue, they've sent it to the family that needs it. Things like that, where people have gotten a little bit more inventive and creative.
Juliet, it's been lovely talking to you. Thank
it's
you so,
so lovely
much.
Chatting
if people
to
want to find you, where should they be looking?
www.julietteburton.co.uk. I'm on Twitter at Juliet Burton, Instagram Juliet_Burton, and Facebook Juliet Burton Writer Performer.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
The Fempire Strikes Back. Badass Women's Hour XL on Talk Radio.
We are very lucky to have in the studio with us this evening the fabulous Eunice Olamide, MBE.
Wow. Congratulations. Very much. Thank you very much for having me. This is brilliant.
So for anyone who doesn't know you, you are a bit of a fashion powerhouse. You started in the fashion industry age 16.
I did.
Tell us how that happened.
It was really strange, actually. I got scouted quite a few times. First of all, I was scouted in Scotland by an agency called Select. Mm-hmm. And then I literally grew up in a council estate. And I think sometimes when you're outside of large cities, you don't actually realise that these are real jobs and this is a real career. So I was like, this isn't real. This is not a real thing. And then I got scouted about another three times. So it was actually on the fourth occasion that I decided to give it a go and just see what it was about. And it turns out, wow, it's actually a real job. It's actually a real occupation that you can get paid to do. So I thought, okay, let me give it a try. And it was really good for me. It gave me the opportunity to travel the world and to see things I'd never seen. And at that time, I had quite a lot of insecurities because I grew up in Scotland. Obviously, there's not a lot of people of colour. So yeah. Strangely enough, the fashion industry gets quite a bit of a bashing, but people forget that it doesn't discriminate along class and it doesn't discriminate in many ways. And actually, it's one of the only industries in the world where women gets paid the same amount of money or more to do the same job as a man.
No, I didn't know that.
So tell us a little bit about what it's like as a young model, because in my head, it's basically America's Next Top Model. You're all living in glamorous houses. There are makeovers left, right and centre. Is that the reality?
No. funnily enough, there's a quote that my publisher decided to put on the back of my book, and I find it quite funny, where I was comparing being a fashion model to being a professional footballer, because it's pretty much the same journey in a way, believe it or not, because you're really young. A lot of footballers start really, really young. They get flown off somewhere. They don't know what they're doing. They're out there. They're competing. They're trying hard. They might get signed to a team or an agent, or you might not. If you get signed to that agent or team, you will then be transferred, or you will then have to sign to other agencies across the world. So your first agent becomes your mother agent. You'll then acquire modelling agencies in the major fashion capitals, so New York, Paris, Milan, etc. You might pick up some in other places, but none of these confirm that you're going to make any money or you're going to work. You will then work really hard and show that you're brilliant. And if you manage that, you might get some paid work. If you manage to pick up a decent campaign, so if you're a footballer, if you score in your first professional game, then you're guaranteed your place for a little while. But that's not definite, because basically as a fashion model, you have to perform every single time. Same as a footballer, like you, it doesn't matter if you were brilliant last year. If you're not on the pitch and scoring, you're not going to stay in the game. And it's the same as being a fashion model. You have to continuously book the top campaigns, the best catwalk shows to have a profile and to have access to better jobs. So it's highly competitive, extremely competitive industry, probably one of the most in the world. I would say only because, unlike things like acting and football, talent does matter. Whereas obviously in fashion, it's much more subjective, I'd say, because you could be competing with somebody who isn't very good, but they have a certain look which is in at that time or is popular. So they could replace you, even though you might be better at walking or posing or whatever else. So fashion is quite different, because talent is important, but not always essential. In some cases, if you're become what I call a working model, meaning you might not be like a household name, but you've made a living from it. It can be good to be talented and good at your job, because then, you know, a client knows, okay, I'll book you because I know that if anything goes wrong on my show, you can save the day. If another model that's young doesn't make it on the catwalk, you're going to come and change four times and it's nothing to you. So occasionally it can be beneficial to be really good at your job, but essentially every season you're in direct competition with people who've had no experience whatsoever.
Wow. Mm. What is the life of a working model? What does that actually mean? Is it just runways? Is it just, you know, shoots and campaigns? What is it? It is kind of opaque, unless you watch America's Next Top Model or Britain and Ireland's Next Top Model.
I kind of feel like it's deliberately like that, and it helps. It adds the clandestine nature, the exclusivity that people don't really know much about it. So that's actually part of the reason that I wrote the book. So there's a number of different categories of models. Most people are familiar with the editorial and the fashion models, which is sort of like our prestige. That's the girls that book, you know, Balenciaga and Versace, whereas actually the models that tend to make the most money on average are not girls that do fashion and are not girls that walk the runway. They're actually girls who are defined as commercial, also falls into advertising or lifestyle modelling. And a lot of the time you're shooting for things like George Asda or B&Q or Foot Locker or Boots or, you know, really everyday products. Now, it sounds a bit crazy, but if you think about it, it makes sense, because these are household products that we use every single day. Mm-hmm. You're much more likely to book a TV advert, something that's going to give you, you know, constant income and residual income when you're doing commercial work. So it's a bit of a myth that, you know, the fashion editorial girls make all the money. Actually, a lot of the time they just make the agency or the company look really good, but the girls, what we call the money girls, are not necessarily work that you're going to display to say, look at my girls, but they're the girls that are actually bringing in a lot of the money most of the time.
Right.
I feel like that's much like a lot of freelance jobs. There's the stuff you do that's the really cool, exciting stuff.
Yeah.
There's all the stuff you do you don't talk about that brings in the cash.
Definitely.
But you're not just, you haven't just been a model, have you? I was researching you today and you're doing so much stuff, but I think it's really interesting. So from modelling, you then got into fashion design. Is that right? You set up your own label?
Yeah, it was actually quite random. I actually only started designing because, obviously, I'm from the hood, yeah. And so I'd go to these events and I couldn't keep up with the style and the fashion and the amount of money that people were spending to look fabulous. So I just started making my own clothes because I just wanted to make sure I was wearing something that nobody else was wearing and I wanted to stand out. So it started out not deliberately trying to make a collection, but I made this collection, and Italian Vogue, an amazing lady called Francesca Rosoni, she picked it up, she published it in Italian Vogue. So wow. Then I started just doing collaborations with companies like Puma and then Avisu, and just doing one-off pieces for them. So that's kind of how I got into designing. But I wouldn't really describe myself as a designer. I mean, I do design products and I have brought them to market, but it's like being a DJ, like everyone's a DJ, but there's a difference between being a designer and designing. So I tend to just do collaborations. I've created like my own sunglasses range, which was consigned to the V&A actually in Dundee, which is quite exciting. And yeah, I do that. And I kind of fell into the arts through fashion. Met a lot of influential artists through designers like Vivienne Westwood, who thought I was a bit of a legend because we share the same ideology, basically on a saving the world type mission. Don't tell anybody, right?
Secret still.
So yeah, and then they nominated me to start an art gallery. I was like, "What are you talking about? I don't know anything about art." And they were like, "That's why we like you." And I was like, wow. "You people do not need me to represent you. I've seen your stuff in the Heathrow Airport, do you know what I mean? You're already a legend." And he was like, "Nah, but I heard you talk and you're like talking about, well, it was more like, "Well, I heard you talk, Eunice, and you're talking about transformational powers and saving the world, and that's what we want for our art. Gosh darn it." And I was like, "Nice one, you get me." So yeah, I totally believe that art has transformational powers, and there are practically no people of colour, never mind women, in art, the greater art market, which is quite fascinating to me. And I just got dropped right in at the deep end. And I was just like, I didn't even know. I was like, "How am I going to run this business?" They were like, "Right, well, you know, we'll give you 75% and we'll tell you everything." I was like, "All right, sold." So next minute I'm at Freeze in the VIP and I don't even know what that is. And I'm like there. But the work that I do in terms of art, the gallery I run, Old Gallery London, based in South, is more about making sure that art is available to everyday people, because we're in a situation where most art is made by working class people, but it's acquired, sold and enjoyed by people from more affluent upper class backgrounds. So there's a bit of a juxtaposition, and it's quite fascinating. It's actually the best thing I would say about educating yourself and skilling yourself up as high as possible in different industries, is you can see the similarities, and you can see. So I could just, like, now I'm thinking to myself, it's almost like, you know, artists are almost like musicians or rappers, because, like, you know, they're making their music, and a lot of the time they're not coming from the best background, but the promoters and the people that are really making the money off of it are coming from a totally opposite side of the track. So I just kind of got into art to fill that gap.
And yes, I particularly loved what you were saying about realising that there just aren't, let alone women of colour, aren't people of colour in the art industry. How is the industry going about changing that, do you think?
I don't think the arts are doing anything at all to change it. I don't think they're even bothered. I think they're just like, "Oh, they can't see us. Wicked. We'll just keep doing what we're doing and we won't tell anyone and they won't notice." So I don't know what's really going on in the world, because obviously art is clearly created by everybody.
Yeah.
But it's just an industry that's highly exclusive. Lot of capital and equity goes through it, and there's various different economic social reasons that it is the way it is. So for me, I found it quite fascinating, quite like disrupting the natural order, which is one of the perks of being an Afro Scot, because I just don't really care, basically. I'm not really bored. I'm like, "I'm here, it's happening, so you better." And they're like, "Oh, she's Scottish, what's going on?" And then they're coming up like, "Wow, darling, are you Scottish? Oh my God, she's African and Scottish." Or you're in safe enough. Like, "Raw fam, I swear that girl, what's your accent? You're from Scotland, raw fam. Yo, like, come here, come. This girl is from Scotland and she's black. I'm like, well, it stands to reason. They've got black English people, they might have black Scottish people too. It's all right. I'll let you off. It's fine.
You know. I'm not going to lie, listening to you and looking at you, I'm like, This
dichotomy. Really,
yeah,
I know.
Yeah, and I'm a Londoner.
I like you because you're honest. Now, other people, but I thought you were French or Brazilian or American. I'm like, mate, stop lying. It's okay. You can admit I'm an Afro-Scot. It's tripping you out. I get it. This is why I don't have my own show on TV yet. Because they wasn't ready for it. They're like, no, we can't have black people with different accents. It'd be like if you were a white Jamaican. It'd be like, nah, you're making that up. You can't be white and a Jamaican.
That's
yes,
exactly
you do
what
get
is it.
White
That's
Jamaicans.
It. You do.
Don't you?
But it's just as weird. And when I hear white Jamaicans, you do have to look at them and like, you're I don't like, understand what's going on here.
Actually real?
Yeah. And yeah. So that's, yeah, yes. Yeah, so. Yeah.
But it's handy because I think one of the things about being a woman, any woman, if you think about it in reality, but if we look at women of colour particularly, is because of the way popular culture has moved from the 80s to now and colonialism and this, that and the next thing, there are perks to being marginalised, which is you should take hold of it, which is what I'm trying to do with the book, and actually utilise it. But because you're so marginalised and alienated, you can literally do anything. Mm-hmm. And nobody's shocked by it because they kind of think you're going to do something mad anyway. but I'm all about taking a negative thing and turn it into a positive thing. So when I wrote the book, I was literally responding to the, like, I'd get like 30 messages on social media. How'd you be a model? How'd you do this? What did you do, agent? Da, 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 da. And I'm like answering all these questions constantly for like 2 years to the point where my real life is breaking down. So then I wrote this blog, ended up trending worldwide on Twitter. So that's how I ended up writing a book. And I thought about it. I was like, you know what? I don't want to tell stories of people who have been exploited. And I don't want to tell stories of like rape and this and that. Instead of doing that, I want to tell people what to do and make it very clear and answer the questions such as, no agent will ever charge you any money. Any agent that asks you for money is not a real fashion agent. Agents sign you because they're going to make money off you. They take commission on that, and that's how they make their money. So, you know, the book is more about prevention, education. This is what you need to do. This is not cool. Actually, even when you're signed, this is also not cool. And letting people know that people like myself are trying to, and people like Karen Franklin and Hilary Alexander are trying passionately to give our industry some level of legal representation, because the fashion industry is like a $1 trillion industry but has no regulation and has no legislation. And I'm pretty sure it's probably one of the only industries on the planet other than art that has no legislation whatsoever. And that's, if for those at home who are listening, if you imagine like FIFA times it by like 20 and then say there's no laws, there's no regulation, there's no legislation, there's no minimum wage, there's no help if something happens to you, agents can do anything they want. That is the situation with fashion. And I think a lot of people are really not aware that that is the situation within the fashion industry. There's no regulation whatsoever. So I'll be working closely with different organisations like Equity, and they're now going to start representing models for the first time. Traditionally, they only did actors. Mm-hmm. And I've been to Westminster and Scotland Parliament and talked about the things. And it's just because you're in a situation where your agent is basically owns you. You cannot do anything. And that puts pressure on you, because when you go to a job, you might be in a situation where you don't want to do something, but you have to do it because you might lose your agent, or your agent might not book you again, or that client might not book you again. So there's so many different levels to the exploitation that happens in our industry. And I just feel that actually, do you know what? Human beings, we go through so much, and the world we're living in right now is so chaotic. It doesn't need me to start talking negatively. I'd rather talk about, well, this is what you need to do to get to where you want to be, and this is how you can do it. and focus on making that true and bringing that through, because none of the guides, none of the blog, you go on Google, you see certain people who I won't mention their names, how to become a model coming up. It's completely vague. It's completely parochial. None of it is actually telling you what you need to actually know to become a model. And it's almost like they don't want you to know. And I don't know if that's just like the very British thing of, well, I had to work this hard, so you're going to have to work as hard as me. But there's a lot of unnecessary suffering and a lot of exploitation, because with an industry that's so massive, you've got all these other like smaller companies and, you know, organizations that spring up around it that are very misleading. And what happens a lot of the time is people get caught up in those ones, which are nothing to do with reality, that teach you the wrong things. They teach you, you know, maybe how your walking is wrong, using arms, wearing makeup. You know, I'm in my book, I make it really clear, particularly for young girls, if you want to be a model, you cannot wear makeup. You need to walk down the street with no makeup on 24/7, because you will never be scouted wearing a face full of makeup. And as we can see, what are young girls doing now? It's like proper,
touring,
ready, like level, you know. And the thing is, you can't get scouted looking like that, because if an agent or a scout sees you, they're not going to say, take off your makeup. They're going to walk past you and go to the next person. So it's just putting in really important information like that. So say you were approached by somebody looking a certain way, you'd probably know that it probably wasn't true and they probably didn't know what they were talking about, because actually that's not what they're looking for.
What's the one thing you would want young girls going into the industry to know about it?
I think for me that you do get made to feel like if you don't do everything you're told to do, you cannot have a career. Now, I think that if you've got enough charisma and you're really good at your job as well, that you can actually overcome. So I don't do lingerie, I don't do bikini, I don't do partially nude, and that's just out of respect for my family. I'm really not prudish at all, but my family would not have it, and that has made my career extremely difficult. I've not had a lot of opportunities, and also had another problem where I had got dropped at a young age from a really big agent in London, because I'm like 30 now, so 15 years ago, like, if you're a black girl like me, you had to have a weave and you had to have straight hair. You were not getting work if you had an afro. But it was really important to me to do that. So I lost a lot of opportunities. But what I would say is, the reality of life is, if you're doing something and you have the drive and the determination to do well, you might have to go a little bit left and right to show that you are brilliant. But eventually, if you keep being brilliant, keep smashing it, they have to use you and they will use you. Do you know what I'm saying?
Brilliant advice. I wish that I could just skywrite that for every young girl. Thank you so much for joining us here on Badass Women's Hour XL. It's been brilliant talking to you. If people want to hear more from you, where can they find you?
You can get me on Instagram at Eunice Olumide. That's EUNICEOLUMIDE. And the book is out now. It just came out and it's called How to Get Into Fashion. Available Amazon, Waterstones, Blackwell, everywhere.
Go buy it, because it's amazing. Coming up next on Badass Women's Hour, we are going to be announcing our Badass of the Week awards.
Badass Women's Hour XL on Talk Radio.
Welcome to the award for Badass Woman of the Week. This is the moment when we highlight the truly great, incredible women who have done something amazing and we want to celebrate them.
So
we are getting the gold envelope ready any second now. We're going to get a statuette, maybe of a naked woman. And there's no female for Oscar, is there? An Oscarina to hand out.
An Oscarina.
We are each week, the three of us are going to compete for who has the baddest badass of the week. Not bragging, I did win it last week. There is a leaderboard.
It's the first week, Harriet. Of course, yeah, like, well, it's, you know, fine. You've just won 1 week.
I just, you know, just wanted to remind you.
Calm down,
so you know.
Calm down.
Just so you know. This week, we are going to start with Emma. Emma, who is your badass of the week?
So mine is a lady called Dame Stephanie Shirley. And I must admit, even though she's got a TED Talk out that's had like so many millions of views, I hadn't really heard about her until about 6 months ago. And somebody I knew was working with her. And I started to listen to her audiobook, which is her life story, and I suddenly realised what an absolutely incredible woman. So she's still alive today. She's about 85. She's now does a lot of philanthropic things, but she was revolutionary within. She's basically an IT pioneer. So what she did is she used to work in IT in the sort of 50s or 60s, and then she set up her own business. But she had to change her name to Steve to get ahead in the IT industry. But what she did is she set up what a lot of modern businesses are operating like this. She's been doing it for like decades, where she tapped into a lot of stay-at-home mums and got them to write code. So she was kind of the first person to have this freelance talent network. And what I loved is that she built this business. She made a ton of money. The way she operated her business was really beautiful. So she floated on the stock exchange, and she gave all of her senior execs all instantly became millionaires that day because they all had shares in her business. Mm-hmm. She's just really inspiring businesswoman, and she now, you know, has got multiple. I don't think she's worth like 70 million, maybe even more. I think she was worth about 200 million at the time she floated. And she's not interested in buying super yachts or living that lifestyle. She still works 6 days a week. She just puts so much back. She had a son who was autistic. Her biography is absolutely brilliant. If you are a female entrepreneur and you want to hear someone who is a badass businesswoman, but also just ran her business with the most amazing values, generosity, Dame Stephanie Shirley is my badass of the week.
I think I could be wrong on this, but I think she came to the UK on Kinder Transport.
So she's
a refugee from the Holocaust.
Yes, and so she had nothing. And I do find that interesting with entrepreneurs. I do wonder that if you've had a childhood where you've literally, she had nothing. Mm-hmm. She came to the UK with nothing, was fostered, and almost had to sort of rebuild her life, that your attitude to risk is a bit different. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But anyway, she's not had an easy life at all. Even running her business was not a, you know, smooth sailing, but there's just phenomenal women. I just absolutely, yeah, totally fangirled her.
Okay. She's a good call. I've actually interviewed her twice, and she's probably one of the most impressive people I know. So I think it's a strong contender
this week.
Yes. Strong contender.
Get in.
Natalie, who is yours?
Rihanna?
No. Although I did consider it. My badass of the week is actually a group. It is the women of the Hub Community Kitchen. They are a group of women that came together post the Grenfell fire tragedy to support each other. And this week they released a cookbook, a charity cookbook called Together, which has over 50 amazing recipes. And the foreword was actually written by the Duchess of Sussex. And the book was her idea.
Meghan Markle, for anyone who's not familiar with the official title.
And the women are absolutely amazing. They are from all over the world. A lot of them have lived, they grew up in the UK. They live in West London. And so having, just getting to know them, they're women that live local to me. And getting to know them through these recipes and the little stories that introduce each recipe, some of them recipes that they just made up at home and some of them that have been passed down from generation to generation. It's just absolutely heartwarming. And the book is also beautiful. And so I've actually fallen out of love with cooking. I pretty much home deliver food most evenings, and I've been inspired to start cooking again and buying ingredients and planning out the sorts of things I want to cook each week. And so if anything changes for me, it might be that I eat more than two or three meals a week that have not been made by a chef in some other kitchen somewhere else.
Fabulous.
They're my badasses of the week.
It's a good call. I like that one. So I also have a group this week. So I have a group which is the female workers of McDonald's. In 10 different cities across the US, on Tuesday, they came together to have their own Me Too movement. So apparently there has been pretty much rampant sexual harassment in the fast food chains industry.
Wow.
It gets reported all the time because it's run on franchise level, doesn't get taken seriously, nobody pushes it up the chain. Workers have, in the US particularly, have very few rights. Mm. If they don't turn up for shifts, if they protest about something, if they don't like their manager, they can be fired the next day with nobody to really protest it to. And there was a lot of sexual harassment going on within, because most of the managers and most of the franchise holders are men. Most of the workers are female. Lots and lots of sexual harassment, and they didn't have anyone to complain to about it. So a group of women came together, talked about what was going on in their respective restaurants, and agreed that as a collective, they would go on strike. And we go on strike here in the UK. It's a big deal. It is a huge deal in the US. You know, it's a much, much bigger thing. They would have no rights. They could be fired. They could be let go. And they came together and they formed a committee including workers, corporate and franchise representatives and national women's groups. So they brought people in to support them. They went on strike and they're demanding that McDonald's, they marched to the head office in Chicago to demand that McDonald's actually start to take it seriously and consider it something that has to be dealt with by the company as a whole, mm-hmm. not on an individual basis. And I just thought that was really badass. Wow, so they're my badasses of the week.
Wow.
So let's have a starter poll. What do we think?
Me.
Me.
Given you can't vote for yourself, who would you vote for?
I think Natalie's. I mean, I love what the women are doing with McDonald's, but I just feel like, you know, for something so lovely to come out of something that's been so awful is a real credit to, you know, resilient, mm-hmm. resilient women. So
Nat?
I vote for me.
You can't vote for yourself.
I actually vote for the McDonald's woman.
Oh, something, stop.
It's about the collective, that collective power action. And marching to head office.
I mean, also that was a super smart vote because I now feel I'm voting for Nat as well. So we're going to have a little internal decision and think about it. I'm going to think about it. And while I think about it, I'm going to tell you that if you want to talk to us during the week, if you've got a badass of the week you want to nominate, come find us on social media. Tweet us at Badass Women's Hour, HR at Badass Women's Hour, our Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all the socials. You can come and talk to us individually as well. You can come find me at Harriet Minter, Nat.
At Nat D. Campbell.
And Emma.
At Emma Sexton.
I've been thinking about it, Ems, and it's tough because, you know, I love Dame Stephanie. I do genuinely love her and I think she's badass. And I'm going to suggest that we maybe bring her back in as a secondary contestant in a few weeks' time. But this week, I'm afraid Nat takes it. I'm going to vote for the collective of women from Grenfell and
graciously.
1, 2, 3, 4! This has been the Badass Women's Hour podcast with me, Harriet Minter, Natalie Campbell and Emma Sexton. If you want to hear more from us, you can come follow us on social media at Badass Women's Hour, HR, or leave us a review and tell us how much you love us. We really need to feel the love. 5 stars should do it.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. this Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.